blue and clear. And nothing about this morning matched Nico's mood. Crit kept silent, running a hand through his dark, feathery hair, never looking up. He had a bandage on his right forearm and one on his right thigh, both spotted red and pink, stiff and yellow toward the edges. Strat replied,
"Whatever you say, Stealth."
Taciturn, stolid Strat, with his wide forehead scabbed up into his sandy hair, spread his scraped hands and dropped them to his sides. His left eye was swollen half shut, his left cheek lacerated, bruised. Fresh souvenirs from Chironea. On his arms, deep cuts were healing, flushed and angry, covered with grease. Stratton, nearly Tempest's size, still had a bad left shoulder from sanctuary duty, long ago and far away. These new war wounds were insignificant compared to what Strat, the stepson's interrogator, had suffered at the hands of a necromant in sanctuary 10 years past. The witch haunted Stratton yet. Nico knew that was bothering Crit, who still hadn't said a word. Critias didn't want Strat going back to sanctuary, not while the witch lived there. But only Tempest could rescind Nico's order, and Simme wouldn't let any of the stepsons see the Riddler. Nico told Stratton, "Ace, bring those 3 Bandaran trainees to me, and the senior Theban after I'm done with them." Nico needed to talk to Crit in private without Stratton there. Strat left, glancing back once over his damaged shoulder at the 2 of them. Beyond Crit, in the circular bullpen, was Sink, rangy and dark, working one of the black sons of Tempest's gray Trose stallion. The colt bucked and bugled to any mare near enough to hear. Several nickered back from paddocks nearby. Critias looked up, pretending to judge the training.
"Nice colt, Stealth. Yours, isn't he?"
Nico said to Critias, "Take him, Fox. He's yours." It couldn't matter less today, although colts of the band's senior stallion were highly prized. What mattered was the Riddler. What mattered was Crit's partner, Stratton.
"I don't need him, Stealth," Crit said,
his face carefully arranged and turned to him.
"Or anything from you," unsaid, but clear as the sky above.
"Then don't take him. Doesn't matter." What mattered was that all 3 of them were using war names among themselves, a sign of tensions high and aggression reined tight.
"What are we going to do about Ace?" Nico asked. "That witch of his in sanctuary might be more than we can handle."
Nico knew all about witches and witchery and the compulsion in your soul you couldn't fight.
"He says she'll be no problem. He wants to go."
Crit's eyes slapped him across the face.
"Not a smart move, this mission. Not now for any of us."
He came 1 step closer.
"It's Tempest's mission, not mine, what he wanted."
"Not if he can't go."
Crit was Tempest's executive officer. He had the rank, if he pulled it, to make a schism out of this.
"Why go now? To help that godsired brat Chorus cage his temper?
So Artan can meet his mommy? So Sham, the wizard boy, can have an outing? To teach the remnants of the Theban sacred band how to get along without their brothers? That lot is grieving so it will take more than new horses and new tactics to heal them. It'll take longer than I want to stay at the world's anus to wet-nurse them. We go where the commander says we go. We do what he wants done.
The colt hit the boards with his hooves and charged Sink in the middle of the pen. A whip cracked. The colt surrendered, stopped, and went back to the rail, ears pinned, eyes rolling.
Who knows what he wants today? Not you, not me. He's not seeing anyone. Strat doesn't need this trip, neither do I. Somebody's got to stay here with the Riddler, if she'll let us near him.
Nalcrit took two more steps toward Nico and jabbed a finger at his chest.
You should stay.
The finger withdrew, but Critias was too full of truth to stop.
This is your mess. Running away won't solve it.
Nico took a deep breath and grabbed his temper. If you'll have them ready to travel, 2 days hence we'll leave, he said.
If.
A small opening for compromise, an acknowledgement of rank necessary with this man, who is protective of his partner, Strat, and everything else teetering on the edge of oblivion here. None of them had ever seen the Riddler take so long to heal. If heal he would. Damn the Theban sacred band and all it had cost them. But Nico had command, and command must not be wasted, not spent foolishly, nor respect and camaraderie lost in anger. Nico's mouth was full of barbs. I'm going to take those Bandaran-trained boys. Crit would never understand Bandaran stricture or care. And the Thebans and the best stepsons who'll sojourn, and leave some in sanctuary a year or two if I can. Come with me or stay behind. This is no time to argue. Now it was out. Open discord. Crit said,
Time? Stealth, you haven't even had time to look in on your own wounded stepsons. What would the Riddler say to that?
Then turned on his heel and walked away, his long stride giving Nico no chance to stop him, unless he wanted to run after Crit like a penitent child. Too much anger, too much helplessness, too much grief. Nico couldn't bring himself to meet with the Thebans yet. He knew he should, but he couldn't face the ghosts in their eyes. So Crit had had to do it. If Tempest didn't recover, then what? The sacred band would be at Simmy's mercy. They served at Tempest's pleasure. All this talk of Nico being Tempest's inheritor was only that. Talk. He went to see his sable mare. Then, on foot, he fled the walled citadel, going down to the shore, through the town where nothing ever had been wrong before, where people lived happy lives, free from want, and the worst thing that ever happened was a bar fight among stepsons or moldy hay coming in from surrounding farms. Tempest and he had brought horses down here to work them in the surf on better days. He was too angry even to think, too taut and regretful to bring the mare. He might make another mistake,
The mistake he had made was a worse error than he'd ever thought a man could survive.
Would the Riddler live? See again? Walk again? Lead again?
None of them could get in to visit, to find out. Nico's fury, at himself and the gods, was driving him, he knew, as it had driven him for so long before he'd joined the Stepsons. He'd lost one partner soon after, then a second. He couldn't lose another. Tempest was supposed to be eternal. At least everyone said he was. Had they so angered the gods, trying to save the Thebans, the fated dead, that Tempest would be taken from them?
Nico walked knee-deep into the surf as if the tide could cool his anger. Long ago, his rage had driven him to Mott, his discipline of will and equilibrium, justice and balance, and those had driven him on to the Sacred Band and the Riddler's service, where he was. Finally and correctly, he thought, Tempest's right-side partner, learning day by day what his commander had to teach. He was, at long last and great cost, an avatar of Enlil on his own. With the Riddler hurt, his anger was nearly ungovernable.
Long spear thunking into flesh, man staggering backward, impaled, groaning. He whispered to the surf, "Help me help him." Only pounding waves answered.
Thebans. These unlucky Thebans were bringing their fate home to roost here. Looking dazed and amputated, full of silent grief for their lost brothers and the entire world they'd known. Better off than dead. He would take them to Sanctuary, the most luckless town he'd ever seen. They would fit right in there. And he and Stratton, Tempest's two witch-cursed stepsons, would face their fears or their doom. It didn't seem to matter. Greater dooms win greater destinies. This his commander had taught him. The next day, after Nico had gone to Simmy, helmet in hand, begging assistance and pleading for mercy, apologizing until he thought his heart would break, she relented and let him see the Riddler. Not long after that, Nico rode beside Tempest as the commander, still healing, led his sacred band of stepsons on their best horses into Lemuria's mystic portal. And out again, to emerge by dint of Simmy's Lemurian power, right onto Sanctuary's northwest shore, with every boy, soldier, and Theban bringing up the rear, just as the Riddler had planned. Once Tempest's vision returned by Enlil's grace, the evening star couldn't interfere with the commander's wishes. Nico sympathized. No one could. Steady drizzle falls. The sky above is restless with scudding clouds. A furious storm masses behind them, out to sea, throwing black spears of rain down from heaven's walls. Dark waves flee inland, surly, breaking on the beach. Riding toward the ochre walls of Sanctuary on his sable mare with the Riddler beside him on his grey Tros horse,
Nico catches Tempest's eye. Tempest stares back, baring his teeth.
And Lil rides with us, Nico, every step of the way.
Wet wind blows like the breath of the gods on Nico's neck. Rain falls harder. Thunder cracks as distant lightning skewers the sea. Since the storm is coming near and his commander sitting easily on his horse, Nico doesn't doubt the Riddler's word. Enlil, ancient storm god of the armies, is with them. And Vashenka, the local storm god, and Nico's mart. And perhaps even the Theban goddess, Harmony, daughter of Ares and Aphrodite. Good. They will need every man and god and skill among them in this hellhole. Even his sable mare knows it. She raises her head and challenges the heavens as they jog along. The stepsons, two by two, Crit and Strat close behind. 66 fighters, all told, come into the city state of sanctuary through the gate of justice. Mott is justice, as well as balance. In all the years he'd served here, Nico had never ridden through this gate. Maybe it will be lucky for them this time, with the child of sanctuary's storm god, a warlock's son, a seer, and all the saved sacred band of Thebes in tow. But Nico isn't counting on it. End of chapter 3. Chapter 4. Two Gods Storming. Drought has clutched sanctuary in her withering hand year after year. Now comes the storm, its squalls howling off the sea, whipping the waves high, swamping boats and rocking the ships of sanctuary's young navy. So seamen rush to weigh anchor and ride out the gale as best they may. Parched earth and fields cracked open from drought can't absorb all this rain, where ground has turned so hard that horses' coffin bones bruise year-round, and a body needs an axe to dig a hole. The runoff steals topsoil from the fields and moves it, silting creeks, turning ponds into lakes and crops into waste. Pastures flood and granaries give up their stores to the ruin of salt and water. When the storm passes, then clean-up will begin. Broken trees and wrecked wagons can be dragged from roads, roofs repaired, wells cleaned of drowned cat and rat. If the storm ever stops, if the fierce gale abates, if the sun comes back in the gray-black sky and the gray-black sea stops churning up its contents to strew the shore with sea-wrack and jellyfish and sharks and whales and worse. If. Around walled sanctuary the storm swells the white and red foal rivers till they burst their banks and lap against cellar, step, and statue. The seaborne storm soughs and blows and whistles and sings its salty song so that those old enough to remember wizard weather take shelter in their attics, digging out old, half-forgotten warding charms. But this storm is no wizard's work, some say, for no charm or ward forfends it. 66 stepsons have come riding into sanctuary, some say, bringing the storm and the wrath of the storm gods down upon them all. The gods are angry at sanctuary, some say, for becoming too irreverent. A lesson must be taught. All this time, the rain rains harder and the gale gusts fiercer. In the palace, a priest called Torch orders sandbags laid. Meanwhile, the oligarchic council tries the power of prayer and prays as it has never prayed before. Down on Wideway and up past the docks, word of the stepson's coming spreads like the swelling tide of brackish water, and people worry for their lives. Mothers hug their children tight and caution maiden daughters, while older women stare out their windows with dreamy eyes, remembering days gone by. On the Street of Red Lanterns at Amelie's Lily Garden and Phoebe's Inn, whores bolt their doors. At the Aphrodisia House, a harlot named Shawmy, dreaming of heroes, peeks out her shutters but sees only the wild wind, swirling rain in arabesques as if invisible lovers dance amid the storm. The storm sees the girl and caresses her face, then moves on. In the bazaar where the city guard captain, Walgren, has taken down a soggy awning from outside his sister's shop, a blousy Zidanzo seeress named Ilira reads her cards. She looks up at her big brother and says, "Artan is coming. My boy is coming home." But she is not smiling, not in the face of this awful storm. Walgren, soaked to his sandy braids and needing to get back out there among his men, says, "What else, Ilir? I know that look." "Death reversed. A son of the storm god, a son of sorcery, a son of fate. The Three of Swords reversed." Hoops shiver madly in her ears as she lunges toward her brother, grabbing him tight. "Don't go back out there tonight, Walgren. Don't." Nevertheless, the city guard's captain goes back to his garrison, hoping that someday his sister, who'd lost 2 children and adopted a 3rd, would mend. Fortune-telling was a poor living where magic didn't work. The storm sees the soldier at his duty where guardsmen heft sandbags to stem the tide and goes another way, whistling. Meanwhile, at the mercenary hostel north of town in its common room, where dusty weapons from bygone wars hang on rufous walls, 66 fighters make themselves at home, filling bowls from the sideboard with possets of curdled milk and wine and honey, while Stratton works out stabling and the order of the watch.
"We'll get it, the 3 of us, whatever stuff you want, sir,"
says Shamshi, the boldest and oldest of the young guard, to Stratton, who has assignments to make from his customary corner table. It's crowded in the common room. Strat hasn't seen it like this since recruitment for the war on Wizard Wall was underway. Today, it was crowded with men of his. There weren't half a dozen other mercenaries here when the stepsons had arrived. Just the eye-patched guild hall master and a cook to see to things. Somehow they were managing to find a bed for every man and a stall for every horse. Now Strat was sending out the seasoned pairs to help with bulwarks, road clearing, and general citizen saving in the storm.
Shamshi, take this list, then, and Artan and Giscarus, and this.
Strat pulled a fat purse from under his woolen chlamys. Bring back what you can, and mind those horses in the rain. The Riddler will have your guts for bowstrings if you lame one. Fair-haired Shamshi was already backing away. A flush in his cheeks, head down, wizard grey eyes on his feet, as if the young stepson were bowing his way out of an audience with a king.
And come right back.
No chance of that. A fool would know. Strat stripped off his chlamys and flung it on a bench. Nico was out at the old stepson's barracks assessing the stabling. 80 stalls comprised the stables. 4 barns for 20 horses each. 2 in line, parallel to the front gates. 1 perpendicular on either side. Plenty of work to refurbish those. Crit was managing 100 things as Crit was wont to do. Stratton was keeping watch over the Thebans who'd roached their hair in mourning and wandered about dazed, wounded, and bruised, holding on to one another. The split in his scalp itched where a curved short sword had cleaved his helmet and kissed him deep. Long spears thunking into flesh, men staggering backward, impaled, moaning. And of course, Strat was watching over the man upstairs. The Riddler was holed up in his old corner room, resting. What did it mean? The commander never slept, could work every man of them into the grave, or could once. Was there something, as Nico and Crit thought, unlucky about the Thebans? Did the fates, who predestined all men's lives, take offense at saving these? But this storm was a consecration, wasn't it, of their mission?
Stratton read it so.
The guildhall master said they'd broken the drought here, riding in with 2 storm gods squalling in the stepson's wake. There'd been a long drought here. The sanctuarites should be happy with the rain the storm gods brought. Maybe they would be when the emergency relief crews got done. No use wondering with so much left to do. The storm lashing this little city was taking was just a portion of its due to Stratton's way of thinking. And the omen of storm was always the best of signs for Tempus and his stepsons. The sanctification of this, or any foray. If you are a man of the Riddlers, in good standing with the sacred band of stepsons, any storm is bound to clear your way. Or at least Strat hoped so, because he'd just sent Sink and Gale down by the White Foal Bridge, where Crit had made Stratton promise under any circumstances not to go. Where the necromant Ishard once kept a small, unassuming house. Where Stratton had gone too many evenings 10 years past. And where he went in his dreams, sometimes still. He rubs his left shoulder, twice arrow shot. Never right, but not too bad today. His scalp wound plagues him worse, scabs pulling on his hair. Sink and Gale would see to that house and any in it, to rescuing anyone who needed help down where the White Foal River found the restless dead, another home. Although the witch who lived in his dreams needed no man's help and never would. He decided he'd go see his ghost horse in the stable out back, the ghost horse she gave him. The ghost horse needed to know that they weren't going back down there. Not this time. End of chapter 4.
Chapter 5. Stepsons and Mothers. The summer storm was easing up, not stopping yet, but not boxing your ears or slashing you across the face or snatching the breath from your nostrils, when Artin finally convinced Giscaris and Shamshi to cut through the bazaar.
"Over here, this way,"
Artin urged the other two trainees, guiding his horse around the wreckage of a produce stall. Some daylight remained, even if the light had that pearly quality of supernal tantrums abating. The sky, no longer boiling like a stewpot, was just a featureless mass of wall cloud. This was as he had foreseen it.
"Time to find my mother."
All had unfolded in accord with his foreknowledge. They had money and horses. They were away from the senior staff, young stepsons loose on the town. After facing so much death on the Kyrenian battle plane, Artin needed to know if his foresight was right, if his mother was still alive. War sears its specter into your memory, doubles the beat of your heart, humbles you because it will take you if it can. Living had become very important, the only thing that mattered. His blackened eye, his scored cheek, his left forearm and hand, blistered from hefting his wicker-framed bronze shield. None of these mattered. The bragging rights he'd so wanted didn't matter. Breathing mattered. The battle had shaken all three of them. Life seemed so fragile. Each sacred band fighter so vulnerable. They were being as brave as they could manage to be. Giscaris, called Kouris by his friends, sidled his chestnut horse close to Artin's bay. Red-haired, green-eyed Giscaris, chin attempting a beard, was Artin's childhood friend. They'd gone to Bandera together, and now were stepsons together. Kouris was the son of the storm god Vashenka and a temple dancer, so everyone said. Artin wasn't anything special in Banderan terms or in any other terms. He could part the veil, sometimes see the future a little, but often didn't understand what he saw in time for it to do much good. He hadn't foreseen how terrifying the Kyrenian battle plane would be. Long spears thunking into flesh, men stagger backward, impaled, crying. Artin had a hawkish nose, sharp chin, dark hair, and eyes that gave him a predatory look. From this, his war name, Hawk, had come. But not his foresight, nor Kouris godblood, nor Shamshi's warlock lineage seemed protection enough after Kyrenia.
"Is this it, Hawk?"
Kouris said under his breath. Kouris had taken a cut on his neck, where an arrow grazed him, a spear wound on his hip and a long slice down his arm from a sword's bite. But Kouris healed like lightning. You could hardly see angry flesh around his scabs today.
"It? I think so,"
Artin replied, softer than his horse's complaint when it couldn't grab an apple from among the leaves and casks and kegs and crates littering the street. Where the street widened, Shamshi brought his horse up to theirs, Rain dripped off his helmet. Sham, of all three, had taken the worst wounds on the battlefield. But no arrow through his thigh or long gash on his shoulder fazed him. The spear that should have ripped apart his lung was somehow turned aside by armor. It was as if he felt no pain from any wound he took. Now they were riding three abreast through fabled sanctuary, boys in stepson's clothing with weapons on their hips. "Is what it? You think what's so, Artin?" Sham snapped. Sham was still angry and defensive about misbehaving in the ranks, earning all three of them 2 days and nights of punitive drill. Shamshi was handsome, with pale hair and the body of a man, not a youth. On Bandera, Sham had mastered several mysteries and was said to have the makings of a formidable adept. Sharp, careful, always wanting to lead, was Sham. But Artin didn't trust Sham, and Sham trusted only himself.
"Well, Artin, speak up," Sham demanded. "Are you lost? This street isn't on Stratton's list."
"We're going to find Artin's mother now," Chorus announced, using that son-of-the-god voice that made his wispy beard immaterial. Sham wouldn't argue with Chorus, not directly. Chorus had a berserker streak when aroused. The wall cloud above pulsed bright twice.
"Well, so be it," Sham retorted. "Just make sure Stealth hears that I'm saying here and now it's not on our list, and if we weren't ordered to stick together, I wouldn't be doing this."
"Noted, for the record," Chorus said, a veiled rebuke. "For the record, in eternity of what we do and what we say that never can be altered." Bandaran protocol. "For the balance of the thing," Artin chimed in, completing the ritual statement. He didn't add that in his premonition Sham was with them when he found his mother. Therefore Sham must come along. And then they were there, at the Sedanzo Cirrus's shop, where Artin's life and his destiny had begun. The shop matched his vision, small and somewhat drab, a bit poor with rot in its wooden steps. Only the awning out front was missing. The awning should be there. Artin slipped off his bay. Chorus got off his chestnut. They tied their horses to a hitching post by the steps. Sham didn't dismount. He eyed the fortune-teller's sign. Straddling the blue roan, he scowled down at them, his swordsman's shoulders squared and his helmeted head cocked.
"You're going to use the stepson's money? For this? Get your fortune told?"
Sham was contrary by nature.
"Stealth will drill us till we can't see straight. I want no part of this."
The roan began backing up, obedient to his shifting weight and one soft cluck, a touch of rein. Chorus said, "You'll come or be damned, Sham." Thunder rumbled. Artin shivered. It was never good when Chorus talked like that. Cursed like that, son of the storm god. Lightning flickered on the other side of town. Rain spattered down Chorus's face, off his arms, glistening like oil poured out for the gods. No one knew if Giscaris's curses were merely words, or more. Artin shivered again. Shamshi grumbled under his breath, dismounting from the roan's offside. How much older was Sham? 4 years? 5? Chorus was nearly as tall, but heavier made, with big bones that belied a natural grace. Artin was slighter, compact, just a peasant boy who'd gotten into Bandera and then the stepsons on a fluke and Chorus's coattails.
"In we go, then, godchild, and let it be on your head," Sham teased harshly.
Chorus looked away, into the blowing rain, muscles ticking on his fuzzy jaw. The threesome climbed up the steps, Artin in the lead. Artin knocked. Knocked again. A little brass peephole opened. It closed. Someone muttered behind the pine door. Then the door creaked open like a sepulchre. A woman stood there.
Was this she? What did they look like to her? Three young wet stepsons on the prowl? Weapons at the ready?
Belatedly, Artin wished he'd worn his helmet like the other boys. In it, he looked more impressive than he was. But it hurt his bruises and it was full of rainwater, hanging upside down from his horse's saddle.
"Yes," said the woman. She made his heart beat fast, so beautiful was she. All bright colors and deep dark eyes, curly hair and long circles of gold in each ear. Buxom and young and...
Artin blinked, and a matron, tired, swollen-eyed, with mud on her skirt, stood there. But the gold circles hanging from her ears were the same. She peered at him.
"Are you coming in, soldiers? We're not really scrying today, but I can. Will?"
Artin said, "We want to see the seeress." Chorus said,
"Are you the Sedanzo, Alira?"
Sham said,
"Can we get this over with? Come in out of the rain. This scruffy fellow here might be your son, Artin, if you're Alira."
The woman said,
"Yes. Oh.
Well, do come in, then." As if sons showed up on her doorstep every day. Then she fainted into Artin's arms. End of chapter 5. Chapter 6. Breath of the Gods. On the Chironian battle plain, the remnants of the sacred band of Thebes saw the spear impale Tempest. They saw him fall. Yet now he lives.
"Wanting neither too much to live nor too much to die."
Tough talk. The Thebans were not so tough now, in sanctuary, torn away from all they'd known and all they'd cherished but life itself and one another. As he rode his dappled troth horse south along the white fold through summer streets, blessedly alone on this warm gray morning, Tempest knew he'd been right to do it. To bring his new sacred banders here where everything was always wrong, where venal fools played at small men's games and battles even smaller. Sanctuary is changed. A mere decade's difference, nothing very daunting to a man who's seen centuries come and go. The streets wind the same way, people scrabbling for a living scramble now as people always do to reestablish normal life in a wild storm's wake. The sacred band of Thebes needs sanctuary, a place to acclimate and integrate with his stepsons. Here they would learn new ways, burn their dead, as stepsons do, thank new gods and meet new challenges where honor and glory are enough. They were his now, and would step up to even greater things, fight for life itself and everlasting freedom of the human spirit. But not yet. Like sanctuary throwing off the damage of the storm, they needed to put their backs into tomorrow, not cry for yesterday. The Thebans must heal, to join with his greater sacred band. Damaged and wounded, ripped and sundered, they sojourned now in a strange new country. At least they were not in the country of the dead. They needed a place to live, to renew their pride, to forgive each other and their pain, not feel guilty that they'd kept the breath of the gods in their nostrils while their brothers had died. Long spears thunking into flesh, men staggering backward, impaled, screaming. How had he thought he could do so much without an awful cost?
Let me spare 23 pairs of yours destined for tomorrow's battle plane, and all my sacred band will stay and fight beside you till the end, and I myself, and mine. And what price there is for that, you and yours will not pay it.
No matter. It was done. And this thieves' world couldn't care a whit where a man was from, or what strange tongue he spoke, or ways he had, as long as he was useful. Drab and sullen sanctuary would teach them much, toughen them up and grow them up while they learned to sing a different song. They were not in the beautiful hills of home now. Tempest's horse knew the way to Aphrodisia House. The clip-clop of its long stride soothed him. Peepers chirped far off. When he got there, he'd invite Molin Torchholder to come and have a talk. Meeting Torchholder, the priest, at a brothel seemed fitting. The street of red lanterns was full of debris, broken shops and shattered dreams, and young men cleaning up in gangs, hoping for tips better than coppers from the madams. Nico would be unhappy, left behind, but Tempest was not a child to be tended. A wind blew in off the disgruntled sea, memory of the storm. He wore shabby leather duty gear, helmet hanging from his saddle, nothing to identify him. Yet men scurried off and women grabbed their children. An armored, mounted mercenary in these streets should not be underestimated even early in the day, before the taverns opened. And the truce under him was all warhorse, impossible to misconstrue. Three city guardsmen, sweating in the muggy air, emerged from behind a wagon of sandbags. They barred his path, spread-legged, across the whorehold's narrow street. One was big, heavy, with sandy war braids and a captain's badge on his shoulder. Perfect.
"Need help, citizen?"
the city guard's Captain Walgren said. Sanctuary was too curious these days. But never mind. Tempest halted his horse. He let the city guard look him over, waiting for recognition to dawn in Walgren's eyes. Then it did.
"I'll be damned and resurrected. Look what the storm blew in!"
Walgren came two steps closer.
"Is there a revolution set for Ill's Day? An undead festival? Palace coup in the offing. The prince governors fled to Ranki. Nobody's here but the oligarchs and us simple folk. What could the likes of you want here?"
Flashing a cautionary hand sign to the two men flanking him, both brashly fingering their hilts, Walgren took one more step toward Tempest. The truce pinned its ears, bunching its muscles under him, ready to spring forward at a touch of leg. He patted its dappled shoulder.
"Good to see you too, Walgren. Ask Torch to meet me in the Aphrodisia House at your soonest pleasure. And come yourself, if you wish."
He signaled his horse to walk on. It snapped at Walgren as it came abreast. The soldier backed off. The horse walked by. Everything on the street was fraught with menace that could yet turn deadly. His back crawled, riding away from the city guard toward the whorehouse of his choice. These locals were up to their necks in muck pits overflowing and looters and every kind of fool out to take advantage in the storm's wake. But no arrows chased him, only the occasional dog. He drop-tied the troth horse outside Aphrodisia House rather than ride it up the stairs as he fleetingly, rebelliously, so wanted to do. Thieves' paradise or not, a fool trying to steal that horse would find he had hell by the reins. Inside, the fleshy Madame Mertis took one look at him, blinked, and then primped herself in his path, all powdered breasts, perfume, and musk.
"It's too early, sir, for my girls." She stared, put a hand to her throat.
Her whole face jiggled, and she said, "But for you, of course, whatever you require." Whispers on the upstairs landing. young girls and boys peeking between the balusters, giggling, hands over their mouths. A quiet room to talk to a man or two. Rooms here were much safer than in the palace or any tavern in town. He was trembling, an unexpected wash of weakness. His chest hurt. Muscles spasmed across his breast.
Damn the gods and their games.
Mertis took him to a room that smelled of smoke with a round table and six chairs and left him without another word. He sat heavily, Simmy's voice ringing in his ears.
How could you let this happen, Tempus? How could these Thebans be worth so much? Oh, gods, what have they done to you? What are we going to do now?
He had never heard her so frightened, not in all their centuries. But once he'd nearly lost her, and he recalled how he'd felt then, to be the one who must find a way where there was none, to save your beloved from certain death, to save your future, to buy another day or 10 or 1,000 from the ruthless fates. Even though he couldn't see her face, she'd made him feel profligate, an utter fool. The wound in his chest hurts so much now that his heart is threatening to stop again. He puts his head in both his hands, elbows on the table, and just breathes.
God, leave off. Take me or don't, but be done with your anger and this game.
He thinks he knows what Enlil wants, but he has preparations yet to make, and the god is not talking to him today. Some 1,000 beats of blood in his ears later, the door opened.
Torch, he said. Don't get up, said Molin Torchholder, the priest who was half-Nisi warlock and swished to a seat in a commotion of robes.
I wasn't going to.
Behind Torchholder, the blonde city guard captain took up a position outside the open door.
Close that.
Torch motioned, and the door swung shut.
What is this, Tempest? To what do we owe the pleasure after so very long?
A decade of age and line and spotted skin on Torch's face reminded Tempest of just how long.
I want to buy or lease the old stepson's barracks. I'll be billeting 60 to 100 fighters here, as in times gone by. You can hire them. Or others will.
He sat back, praying his body would cooperate, crossing his arms over his chest. Under his chitin and his leather armor, it feels as if the wound is seeping. What if blood leaks out, runs down his leg, onto the chair, the floor, for anyone to see?
Meaning we're going to need you and yours?
Meaning someone will. So say the gods. You might, if we can agree a price.
So they haggled. Torchholder set a price for Tempest's purchase of the barracks and the 100 surrounding acres. Tempest set a price for the hire of the band by the month and year and a statement of work listing responsibilities for stability operations. Costs were argued, apportioned. The band would augment the city guard as necessary but manage its own missions, be on call to discharge sanctuary's ground-based military treaty responsibilities, and defend the city-state in emergencies. Expeditionary warfare and countering magic or sorcerous incursions were agreed to be outside the scope of work. The palace would provide funding, logistical support, materiel and equipment. The band would provide strategic planning, personnel and implementation for crisis management as well as peacekeeping, including site security for public events on a cost-plus basis. Tactics, techniques and procedures were left to the discretion of the sacred band. When they had shared some watered wine and nearly come to terms, there was a disturbance outside. Then that disturbance was inside, under wraps.
Nico, join us, Torch, you remember Stealth, my right-side partner?
Nicodemus came to stand by Tempest, behind his seat, only a brush of his hand on the Riddler's shoulder and his empty eyes showing his temper. The palace priest, who had been Sanctuary's actual ruler for so long, looked up at Nicodemus and shook his head, a tiny movement.
"Now I believe it, that you've brought that whole accursed sacred band of yours. You know magic is in decline here these days. No troubles with witches or warlocks. No work for this kind of fighter."
"This is not the old band, or at least not all. Be gentle with my new fighter's torch for your city's sake and your own."
"I think we have an agreement, Tempest, your higher set," said the priest.
"There's the breath of the gods on these dice. Go carefully, Molin."
"Fine. The deal's done. Torch, you'll be happy to know that your storm god Vashanka has returned, within his son, Giscaris, your scheme fulfilled. Let's hope the god and youth find you pleasing in their sight."
Torchholder had arranged the god's ritual rape of a temple dancer years ago. Giscaris was the issue of that mating.
"And the youth is with my sacred band."
"Oh," said the priest. "Oh, I see."
"Riddler," said Nico at the same moment in a whisper,
"I need to speak with you."
"We're finished here," said Tempest. And they were.
Outside, Nico's sable mare, tied to the post, had her tail over her back, winking lewdly at his trosts and nickering come-hither propositions. This was a whorehouse, after all. If those two horses had been any closer or poorly trained, there'd have been a breeding in the street. Tempest climbed up on the troth and had to remind it of its job. His chest felt better. He hadn't left a trail of blood behind. At least the god had spared him that humiliation.
"Commander, there's a problem with the trainees."
"Then put it right, Nico." Stealth was sheepish, coming after him and finding nothing wrong. "We're moving out to the old stepson's barracks in the morning. Send Sink and Gale out to see what else we'll need to do there."
"This will be the third time we've moved in there,"
Nicodemus reminded him, eyes searching, judging how he rode, watching where they went, and not daring to ask what he wanted to know. How Tempest was healing. "It's better every day," he told Nico without being asked. He hoped it was, this wound, which would have killed him if he'd been mortal. The god was never slow to heal his avatar unless he was very angry. "We need to deploy the band, get those Thebans where they can do more than mourn their dead, have a funerary rite of our own out there so those who came away with us can say farewell to those who stayed behind. For all the fated dead, maybe that would placate the angry gods. Maybe." On the afternoon chosen for the funerary rites of remembrance, the sun blazed bright in a clear blue sky over the stepson's barracks so familiar from former times. They could not have chosen a better day for this, Tempest thought. Although the Thebans will honor men whose bodies lie back in Chironea, this rite is necessary for the survivors. The grief of the living will go to heaven on the balefire. Out in back of the training ground with its rail fence where stepsons drilled Theban sacred banders and each other, beyond the ancient amphitheater all was nearly ready for the ceremony. Grass, so bright green it was nearly blue, gave its sweet-smelling thanks for the rain. On the hill past the copse, the stone altar of the storm god was being prepared. Men labored around the pyre, others on the empty ceremonial bier, some briskly, some gingerly, those hurt or still dazed. Three men were dragging a tree limb toward the altar to add to the pyre when one, a stepson, dropped in his tracks. The Theban pair with him called out for help, gesticulating. Men came running, shouting, crowding. When Tempest got there, pushing the curious aside, it was too late. One of his own stepsons, half a sacred band pair, was dead, lying flat on his back, sightless eyes open, staring at the sky.
"What happened?"
Tempest asks, bands of pain crushing his chest.
"My partner and I were right beside him, pulling this branch he just